This is meant to be sort of an informal discussion, which I agreed to lead. Sasha asked me on basically what are sort of relevant topics in the use of dynamical mean field theory in for electronic structure calculations. So so a lot depends basically on what the audience wants to hear. So what I brought here is I have lots of talks, papers, but what I find it would be most useful is if I use the board and we do this in an interactive fashion, and Sasha and Silke Biermann have agreed to help. So the question is, many people ask for sort of tutorials or introductions, and there's a lot of material, so it's not very easy to organize. But what I thought it may be good is sort of first spend a few minutes on philosophy of what are we trying to do, because I think that a lot of problems in how to interface electronic structure and many body theory has to do with what are the problems that we would like to approach. What are we because after all, a lot of people here are developing methods, and methods in itself have no value. They're tailored to certain things. So I can give you a little bit of what my philosophy of what we're trying to do, and we can discuss that, what people would be interested in. Then I think we have to introduce something about dynamical mean field theory and how it's used for electronic structure calculations. So there are now many different extensions. Dynamical mean field theory is a very flexible tool, and it's been upgraded in many different ways. So what I thought would be useful for this audience, perhaps, if to give you some feeling of what are their extensions, what do they do, and how they could be suitable for whatever you guys are interested in doing, and you can stop and interrupt me at any point. And there are basically different ways of extending dynamical mean field theory. But for that we need some constructions, and there are really basically two ways of going at dynamical mean field theory. One is using a cavity construction, which I think it's so basic that one ought to explain, and the other way is using functionals. And once we understand these two things, then it becomes clear that there are many different extensions, and some extensions are what is called extended GMFT, which we'll see as some improvement in how we build this cavity construction. And other extensions have to do with clusters, how one applies GMFT to clusters. And the third extension is, and that has to do with, again, a difficult problem that we're facing, is how to interface with electronic structure methods. And in principle, having those extensions in mind and having these methods based on functionals or the cavity construction and these two developments of dynamical mean field theory, I think it becomes possible to interface these methods with LDA, and we have what it's called LDA plus GMFT, or with GW, and we can have GW plus GMFT. So what I would like to do is basically try to, or at least start explaining the basic ideas how these things are done. And then I think it will be interesting to have to see some applications of things, many things at the very beginning, but at least there is one self-consistent implementation of LDA plus DMFT, so we can apply, we can discuss some applications if you want. So I think that that will be probably something which might be worthwhile to cover, but I'm sort of open to suggestions. This is not a well-prepared talk, as I said. I have lots of talks on various different things, and I'm just going to try to put these things together. Okay, so if this is sort of the program, and again, I mean, I don't know exactly how much technical detail people want to see, and I don't know how to handle that. It cannot really be done in the context of 1 or 2 hours. I mean, there's just too much material. So let's see. Let's try to proceed. And Sasha and Silke agreed to help and in this presentation. Okay. So function F5, I guess. And F5. Okay. So just as an introduction, what do we want to do, okay? So for this audience, I don't need to explain that we are in excellent shape in terms of describing weakly correlated materials. And I think that the reason we're in excellent shape is, yes. And the reason why we're in excellent shape is because we understand on a conceptual level how to think about all the physical properties. And also, we have sort of quantitative methods for computation. And what I mean by that is that, in principle, the density functional theory provides some good total energies and a first approximation to the band structure, which empirically is not very far from what people see. And then on top of that, one can do perturbative calculations in the Coulomb interactions if one wants to do better. And this seems like a fairly successful program from what I can see in the literature. I don't mean to say that this is a closed subject. And in fact, hopefully in this workshop, we're going to have more discussion of what is the precise point where this program for weakly correlated stands. But I think that's sort of in reasonable shape. And this is basically what underlines that basically we have a model for understanding solids. And I also wanted to put here what is the idea of a Kohn-Sham reference system, because I think it's a very important concept. And the concept is basically that an interesting property of the exact system, such as the density, can be reproduced by a reference system of non-interacting electrons. And this reference system of non-interacting electrons is such that the density of this system equals the density of the interacting system. And basically, in principle, there is a functional here. If I cross LDA, there will be an exact functional, an exact potential, which is meant to describe the total density of the truly interacting system. And then in practice, what people do is they construct approximations, like the local density approximation to this exact functional. And as I said, that's an excellent starting point for not only for thinking about what's going on in the solid, but also for actually performing real computations. And taking advantage that I have here PowerPoint, I just like to show one transparency to show how impressive that thing is. I mean, this is the experimental phonons in silicon, And the theoretical phonons computed in LDA. And basically, there's a huge review of that. And you see, I mean, with the accuracy of 1%, that stuff works. So it's really a practical, reliable tool for computing many different properties. Okay? So that's where weakly correlated.
Particularly phonons, I gather, I mean, rather than electronic gaps and so forth. Is that correct?
Things which are connected with the total energy. However, I believe that, and again, this will be a subject of discussion. There are many people which are currently working in GW. I personally think that once these issues of self-consistency, inclusion of core states, and things are sorted out, people will have the necessary tools also to do gaps in semiconductors. That's my personal belief, but this is sort of an open question, and there are people who are currently working on that. But I think that it's within the regime where clever perturbation theory has the right to work and eventually will work. Okay, so now we go to another kind of system, and I stress this because this is a regime where many materials find themselves. And this goes back to Mott, and is the regime where we take atoms and we bring them together, but they're far enough that they're still not able to metallize. And the effective super exchange between the atoms is sufficiently weak that the system has not ordered yet. These systems will definitely order at zero temperature, and they will form interesting patterns of spin and orbital ordering, but there's a wide, broad regime of temperatures where we can really think of the systems as essentially collection of paramagnetic atoms and treat the super exchange as a perturbation. And that's what is called sort of the local moment regime. And it's interesting because it occurs in nature. And there are many correlated materials which are in the relevant temperature range where you measured in a situation which is not very far from this. So this is sort of the regime which is not easily reachable by density functional theory, because in this regime, the correct reference system is not a band of non-interacting particles, but is more, the local description of this is more like a collection of atoms with open shells. And it's a very broad regime, and it applies to many, many materials. I just can give some examples: nickel oxide, manganese oxide, iron and nickel at very high temperatures, the manganites, for example. What changes when you go from the heavy fermion systems in some regime, what changes when you go from system to system is what precisely here, what sort of the character of the atom that you put in. And in this regime, I think that in terms of conceptual picture of what's going on, I think we also understand that, but we have a different reference system, and the reference system now is basically a collection of atoms, and it's a regime where the excitations now are no longer the excitations of the Kohn-Sham system, but they're really atomic-like excitations, and that's why it's called the lower and upper Haber band. So that's a second regime, and this is just for what for me is a classic paper by Fujimori, which demonstrated that indeed these ideas are actually realized in experiment. What he did is he just took several transition metals and ordered them by the ratio of their U over W, and starting with something which has a nice insulating gap like yttrium titanium O3, took something which is really a band system because we're dealing here with 4D electrons and such as rhenium oxide, And what he showed using photoemission spectroscopy is that essentially there are really two features in this correlated metal. We have these Haber bands, and we have here some quasi-particle bands. And those are two essential ingredients of the electronic structure of correlated solids. So far, the paradigms that we have to describe quantitatively a system is basically this Consham density functional based GW-like approach. It would apply here. And if we want to talk about this kind of insulator, the yttrium titanium O3, we can do atomic-like physics and use Mott's paradigm. But when we are in this regime, when we are in this soup, we don't have methods from electronic structure which can deal with this. And that's sort of the challenge. And the reason why it's not a trivial problem is because it's not easy to get from a perturbation theory point of view into that region. That's a region where the perturbation theory fails. The reason why it fails is because if you start doing your GW here, starting from the band, this kind of approach never produces the proper satellites, the proper Haber bands. It's almost like there's a barrier beyond which the perturbation theory cannot go beyond. And it's of course easy to understand that if we start with a picture where we have well-formed Haber bands, then it's very difficult to get some binding of the upper and the lower Haber band in order to produce this quasi-particle peak here. So this is sort of from the point of view of methods is a non-perturbative region. So the philosophy, the things that we're trying to do is where we would like to go at this region. And okay, for this audience, I don't have to give any motivation why it would be worthwhile to have something which has some accuracy and can access this interesting non-perturbative region, because there are many interesting things that work there, that occur there. And pretty much all the compounds that we know do interesting things, systems which have metal insulator transitions, systems which have high temperature superconductivity, systems which have large masses such as the heavy fermions, systems which have large thermoelectric power, systems that have large optical nonlinearities. All these materials are in a situation where this basic contradiction between atoms and bands has to be resolved. So we need to have some tools to get into that region. And particularly what I was interested in getting at is trying to understand the Mott transition. For me, the Mott transition in vanadium O3 is, in some sense, one of the simplest problems, because head-on, you really have to go, as you apply pressure, from this paramagnetic insulator, which has essentially Curie-like susceptibility, to this metal. And that's something that occurs in nature, something we would like to describe. And also, is something which will force us to develop new tools, because we have to really get something that works in these non-perturbative regions. And so that's basically the motivation and the philosophy. And now, to understand why we want to have something which is realistic, and just to give you some historical background, for a while, I mean, trying to have some methods and describe this was an open problem, but it was solved in various works by the group in Ecole Normale, my group at Rutgers. And there were some toy models which displaced the phenomena and methods based on dynamical mean field theory which can enter this non-perturbative region. But at the same time, it was completely clear that this is only part of the story, and it's necessary to go beyond that to make it realistic, to describe many different materials, etc. And just to make this point more clear, there are many systems. This is an organic material which also has the same high temperature phase diagram, but at low temperature is quite different. So if you just come from a model Hamiltonian perspective, you're sort of puzzled in the sense that you have something that more or less looks like what people see experimentally here, but you have some toy model. You cannot say whether it applies to vanadium oxide or to the cup organics or to nickel selenide, nickel sulfide. You have something which you know has the mod transition, but is not system specific. So we have this strong motivation to try to really understand now, not why all these systems are similar, something which I believe that we understand now, but why are they different? And how we can, since Matt is here, in terms of the RG trajectories, we feel that we have somehow understood. We can go from high temperatures and understand what's going here. We feel that we predicted lots of things, so we're on the right track. We would like to push that to the next step. And the next step is going to be harder because we have to understand more things.
But where they differ is at low energy, isn't that you're going to have many different conceivable qualitative, many different physics going on there.
Yes, and absolutely it is. Here we have an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. Here we have a D-wave superconductor. This guy decides to have here a huge region of anti-ferromagnetic metal, and here paramagnetic metal, and here anti-ferromagnetic insulator. The V203 that doesn't do that. It just likes to do an anti-ferromagnetic insulator to paramagnetic metal transition, and there's sometimes a very tiny sliver of metallic anti-ferromagnetism, but it's very small. So it's clear that we have something which is sort of a rough zeroth order picture of something, but a lot more things need to be done. But also, this understanding this is what convinced me that one needs to be system specific to make progress. That is, that and that's at least the motivation for me how I got into this trying to understand electronic structure. Okay, so that's sort of a little bit of the philosophy, and what we would like to do is the goal would be to have something which works as well as the things that we currently have for weakly correlated electrons, but can be applied to situations like this where the density functional theory completely fails, is totally unable to produce this kind of phase diagram, and it's totally unable to describe this phase. I think that that's sort of the central problem. We believe that at least with DMFT, we can really describe this intermediate regime where we have both atomic and band-like character, at least for a while. And therefore, it makes sense to try to develop these methods further. So that's sort of a little bit of philosophy. And now, after the philosophy, let me now introduce DMFT in a way that I think we will be able to discuss what are the extensions in a meaningful way.
Gavi?
Yes.
Before you start?
Yes.
Maybe a quick question about philosophy.
Yes.
So at high temperature, I understand, we have more or less universal behavior, and with DMFT, we have a feeling we understand what's going on.
Yeah.
To some extent. On the other hand, you started out with the statement that this high temperature behavior is really what characterizes the picture of a strongly correlated system. Now, I'm wondering if there is something like a characterizing feature of mod insulator at zero temperature or at low temperature.
Good question, isn't
it? That's a big question.
I'm wondering, does it make any sense to look for a better functional in the context of DFT, or is that an unreasonable enterprise from the start?
Okay, so that's why I think we should be system specific. The question is, what do we want to describe? I mean, if you want to describe what happens at zero temperature, okay? On purpose, I've been starting the discussion starting from high temperatures and moving down. Why? It's because at some point I sort of changed my strategy. I mean, for a while, I mean, it was much more appealing to think that that was too complicated and one would find some simplicity, and I think it's still a perfectly tenable strategy to try to understand what happens at low temperatures. But at low temperatures, we have many kinds of order, and we have some interesting phases, which are the, I would call them RVB phases, where you can have MOT insulators which are actually not ordered. So it depends basically what is what you would like your density functional theory to do. If you would like to sort of be able to predict whether something is an antiferromagnet and something a superconductor, etc., I think there's some hope that one can construct some decent functionals that might work in that regime, simply because the order state is adiabatically continued to a system of non-interacting particles described by a Kohn-Sham reference system. So if you have order for certain kinds of order, and for the things that we have here, I think probably the answer is yes. And at very low temperatures, I think we understand many order phases, and I think that you have a good chance that you will come up with a good functional which has predictive power. On the other hand, it's hard, it will, yeah, so in principle it's possible, but
the
I'm quite...
The fact that you are, have different things for different materials, this smells already like it wants something like a good density function, because it is the essence of density functional theory that the functional is universal, right? That there is no functional for vanadium oxide or iron oxide or what as a universal function.
Well, we also want to have...
temperature, the idea is that it predicts the material-specific properties. That's exactly the idea.
But the subtle differences between many of these low temperature phases are not in the density.
Right. That's the exact point.
You know, subtle phases of the wave function.
Right.
You know, maybe the, what's that?
How do you know?
Well, when you can
lie on back on, everything is in the density.
In principle, yes.
No, but it's a fact. I mean,
it's a fact.
You need to look very closely. You need to know at
yeah.
which property
so,
of the density you have to look.
Again, so this is a question of research strategy, and again, every person is free to choose their own. I mean,
every person is free to choose the wrong strategy.
Now, what Matthew is saying is that given the way that things have developed from high temperatures, and it's unlikely that it will be possible to find such a tool. I mean, my favorite example is, say, if alpha gamma cerium. You have two phases. They're not, if they're near this, they also have a phase diagram like that. Near this endpoint, they're not very different in terms of density, but they're quite different in terms of spectra. So if you're only looking at the density, if all you have is a density functional, I think your chances of describing that are less than the guy which will have a spectral density functional who is able to characterize the different phases, not just for the using the density, but for using some spectral function. So the question is not really what is the minimal description of this which would allow us to do calculations, but what has some practical chance of succeeding. So, and just to give an example that will be dear to you, I mean, let's think about magnets. In principle, I could try to understand nickel and iron using spin density functional. But also, Kohn and Hohenberg told us that I don't need to do that. I can just look at something which is only a function of the density. But in practice, you get nothing out of just pure density functional for not even iron and nickel, right? So in that case, it's better not to have the minimal description, which would be to look at rho of R, but to have the minimal practical description, which is the densities of the up and the down things. So the philosophy behind the MFT is that for these materials that I just happen to be interested in, not for semiconductors and metals, but for these strongly correlated electrons, the minimal practical description is not just the spin density, but also we need to look at least at the local spectra, because that will allow us to distinguish better between the different phases. Because what's going on as we move in this region are basically subtle changes in the spectra. So that's, but again, that's why I said this is just pure philosophy, and it's just, this is really a philosophical discussion, which I think is very important to exchange ideas as to where do we want to go. But I wanted to sort of highlight also, perhaps just to be provocative, this also highlights the difficulties for renormalization group-based methods, because in these regions, what are the effective degrees of freedom are changing. Yeah. So if you have sort of a weak coupling perturbative RG, you will never catch this.
But renormalization group ideas don't necessarily mean you're doing perturbation theory around object.
I understand. I understand. So I understand that very well, and that's why it's so important to bias your RG schemes, so that as you proceed in your RG, you have some of the physics that we already understand works from these simple dynamical mean field calculations. Again, that's for the philosophy.
It just seems to me the differences of philosophy are really that you either try to come down in energy and you know sort of figure out where you're going, or you perhaps say, I'm going to just try to guess behaviors at very low energies as to where I ultimately am going. At least I try to understand those first and then build up. I
mean, and that's perfect. And those are complementary approaches. So,
hopefully they meet in the middle.
Yeah. and I think that they can interact in a very constructive way, because sometimes by looking as to where you're going, you may catch some glimpse of what the ultimate fixed point might be. And then sometimes if you know what are the degrees of freedom at low temperatures, you can tailor your RG so that it ends in the right place. So I think that, that's complementary. Absolutely. Okay, so now, can I start now with the nitty-gritty a little bit? Okay, so now let's leave the philosophy, and now let's understand basically the dynamical mean field construction. So basically, any dynamical mean field theory, what it does, it tries to map a lattice problem to a local problem. And basically, the way it's done is it depends on the system at hand. In the case that you have spins, you basically describe all the other spins by an effective field. Now, when you have a quantum Hamiltonian, then what you need to do is you need to look at your action. And then, if we start, for example, with a Hubbard Hamiltonian, then what we are doing is in the action for this site, we keep here the local term, and mu, the chemical potential, is also local, and that's sort of the term which enters always in the action. But this Tij, which is the thing that connects the different sites, is replaced by a mean field, and that's what it's called the vice field of the problem. So formally, I could think about this like this. I can start with the exact partition function of the problem, and I can trace out all the degrees of freedom except for those who live at that site. If I do that, I will certainly generate a term that looks like this, but I will generate many other terms. I will generate a renormalization of the 4-point function, 6-point function, etc. And the simplest dynamical mean field approximation is the one which only keeps the term here in the quadratic part, but I'm already hinting that there will be extensions to this approach in which we try to keep more stuff in this kind of cavity construction. So this is sort of the first step. This is just equivalent to saying, well, in the classical case, I sit at one side, I integrate out all the other spins, and then what I will get is something which has the form H effective times S0. The second step is to figure out how to compute this vice field, and we can for sure compute it, because if we have this, we can compute the local Green's functions. But now comes the subtle part. We need to find a self-consistent equation which relates the vice field to the local observable. And that's equivalent to this equation here. And here we may come back to the talk by Patrick Bruno yesterday, in which he basically explained that, okay, there is mean field where you determine H effective like this, but there are ways of going beyond mean field, like the one that he explained, in which this effective field is determined in a more sophisticated way, so as to try to reproduce better the local properties. So to get started, this is the usual dynamical mean field theory, which becomes exact in the limit of infinite dimensions of Metzner and Folhart. And it simply says that in this problem, I can look at the Green's function in two ways. I can say that, OK, I have a local self-energy. And here what's written is the local self-energy. And then if I do the sum over k, I get the Green's function from the point of view of the impurity. And here I get, the Green's function from the point of view of the lattice. And this is the Green's function from the point of view of the impurity. So perhaps I should explain this on the board, because it's sort of basic. So just simple derivation of the mean field equations. You say that you have a self-energy which is local. The Green's function should be I omega minus ek minus sigma. This from the point of view of the lattice. This is the local Green's function. And now this is also the local Green's function, which is a functional of delta from the point of view of the impurity. Now I will eliminate what sigma is. I will sort of require the sigma of lattice is the same as sigma of impurity, which means that sigma of I omega here has to be equal to G0 minus 1 minus G minus 1. And then I will simply, G0 is I omega plus mu minus delta minus G minus 1. So I simply substitute this thing in here, and I get a nonlinear functional equation for the Weiss field. So that's basically the usual construction. And again, this is exact in one limit where the coordination gets large, scaled in the proper way. And what we'd like to discuss now is, again, how can we, now that we understand this construction, we can discuss, at least from the point of view of the cavity construction, how this is going to be, how this can be extended. Okay? So the first thing is to say, okay, this is what I just explained. But now let's say, for example, that I add to my system some long-range Coulomb interaction. Because, again, ultimately, we are trying to do electronic structure, and we want to treat electrons which sort of interact with a long-range Coulomb. And a way to incorporate this is now when one does the cavity construction, one can think of what kinds of terms this will generate. And then instead of leaving this U and renormalize, we can imagine that this Vij, which couples all the various different sites, will produce some D0 here. And then there's going to be some self-consistency condition, which determines the D0, which is entirely analogous to the self-consistency condition that determines the G0. And that's an extension that I think is useful for the things, for example, that Patrick Bruno raised yesterday, in terms of how one can go about combining more sophisticated methods of treating spin fluctuations with the dynamical mean field theory, because I can play exactly this game, not just for the charge, but also for the spin. Now, how to sort of, a simple way of remembering these kind of equations, what we're doing here, is think that you want to treat your system by using some Haber-Stratonovich field. So, yeah?
Can you get the two particle properties out of like the plasmon?
That's a good question. So let me answer on the board. So what are we doing here in this approach? We can think of, the simplest way, I'll answer your question after I say one thing. The simplest way to to derive these equations is to think you introduce some auxiliary field, which is conjugate to the density fluctuations, and then you have a system of fermions coupled to bosons. And then, instead of doing the old DMFT, where you only treated the fermions, you treat the fermions and the bosons exactly on the same footing, and the same self-consistency condition that you had for the fermions, you apply for the bosons. So that means, essentially, that pi, the full charge density correlation function, will now...
The boson self-energy is local as well? I mean, is that...
So I'll explain what it means. So that means that the boson self-energy for the Coulomb problem will be some guy like that, this pi star. Okay? So then that's sort of the caricature of what the density-density correlations look if you're trying to do this. And it will describe, in an approximate way, the plasmon, and it will describe also in an approximate way the screening in a metal. And the point to make, of course, is this pi star was a function of omega and q. You will have the exact answer. This is sort of the best local approximation for this. Now, again, you should, when we start playing this kind of game, we're really now guided by physics because there's no small control parameter to help us here. And something that you can observe is that this is not going to be very good if you have an insulator, because if you have an insulator, the functional form of your pi star now will have some q square in front times f of omega and q. But I think that in that case, what you should do is use some kind of different decoupling where your basic variable is no longer the density but sort of the polarization, and try to play with that. So in other words, what we have here is ways, given the fact that you are going to use a local approximation, this kind of machinery gives you the best local approximation. But you should think in terms of which degrees of freedom things are going to be local. But it's quite clear that that gives you more flexibility than not having this. And that will allow us to capture more physics and get better approximations. So this is basically one of the things that I wanted to introduce, which is...
Can we ask a small question?
Sure.
Is this VIH supposed to already incorporate the screening or not?
No. This is the Baer-Coulomb interaction. This is your starting Hamiltonian.
So the screening comes out in...
In a self-consistent manner from this. Okay. Yes. And again, it's... All right. Okay, so that's basically just to show that we can treat, with this approach, we can treat both collective modes and quasi-particles more or less in an equal footing.
So that discussion you were giving was about the extended Hubbard model, because the Hubbard model itself has no plasmons.
That's completely true, right? So this term, the self-consistency for the D0 involves this V. If I set this V here equal to zero, you see this pi cancels with this pi, and I'm left without a D0 and without all these effects. Okay?
Do you have a feeling how good this description of the plasmon angle will actually be?
No, I mean, this is something that we're sort of currently beginning to work. It's one of the topics that needs to be explored. Yes, I mean, I think at this point, where is the field? I mean, there are many directions in which we can move. This is not the only improvement that... or extension of this method. There are various ones, and we have to really understand what are the ones that look more promising for the various things. I wanted to stress that basically, in terms of the EDMFT, I mean, these ideas for spin have been used extensively by Chimiao Si to try to analyze quantum critical points. To try to analyze quantum critical points. So there, I mean, the attempt is to construct, if you want, new kinds of fixed points using this kind of method. I mean, I personally don't subscribe to this philosophy simply because I don't trust, from what I've seen, I don't trust these things enough, these local approximations. Every time that I've been doing those local approximations, I see that eventually they break down in some scale which has some interpretation as a real scale. But in principle, it's perfectly possible, conceivably, that it could be. I mean, in that case, it would be wonderful because you would start from high temperatures with a dynamical mean field description and end up at even at zero temperature with a dynamical mean field description. But again, this is open subjects of research and will be discussed. Chimiao will be later on here. Okay. So let me see what.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I mean, in classical mean field theory, there's sort of this Weiss cavity approach, and then there's Landau theory.
Right.
And which, you know, in some sense, Landau theory was more effective at going, generalizing beyond mean field theory and putting in the spatial fluctuations than, you know, starting with a Weiss mean field theory and going towards the clusters. And I'm just wondering, is there a formulation of the dynamical mean field theory more in the spirit of a Landau theory so that the spatially uniform solution of some more general functional representation reduces the dynamical mean field theory?
Right. No, I understand exactly what you're asking. In the context of spin glasses, people have sort of tried to construct that in which they sort of have tried to have some Q matrix, which is a function of omega, and then try to write some gradients of that Q matrix. But to write the Landau theory, the reason why Landau was able to make progress is because he understood what were the degrees of freedom that were important. That was sort of the basics.
Yes.
I think that the reason why this problem is interesting and needs more work is because we don't completely understand what are the degrees of freedom which are important at each energy scale. And in the models that we can solve, so Landau-like description is always restricted to some neighborhood of somewhere. So in this phase diagram, in this complex phase diagram of T and P, and where we have this mod point, I mean, we were able to derive a Landau-like description starting from the mean field equations to describe what is the critical behavior there. Okay? So there you can take, for example, the mean field theory. You can sort of see that not all the Weiss field is important, that they're really that you can get away with some expansion and simplify a lot. Instead of having a function, you can reduce it to some number, which is the mode that goes soft exactly at that point. And we were able to actually make some analysis of some experiments based on that simplified description. But that's because we understood what's going on around here. And then on top of that, you could add your gradients. And I think that would allow you to understand, for example, why some things should behave in an Ising-like fashion in three dimensions and not in a mean field fashion. But that would be completely irrelevant to what's going on in there. And the beauty of this thing is that by having the function, one can capture how things evolve as a function of length scale, and one can have more freedom. But of course, if something interesting is found around a specific point, of course, one can do simplified Landau-like analysis. Okay, so I think I said enough about the extended DMFT. So let's see. I mean, I'm using all the time. I mean, should I stop here or should I go a little bit more?
Yeah.
Okay, so now I would like to describe a little bit how we do clusters before I switch to functionals. I should give references. I mean, the work of Xi and collaborators started in 1996. And since then, there's a lot of work that these people have done in terms of the analysis of the quantum critical point of heavy fermions. Our efforts were more focused on developing this technique to make a quantitative tool out of it. So starting with some paper where we discuss what happens with long-range Coulomb interactions on the mod transition with Chitra.
Yeah, but what exactly does your E include E-DMFT? Extended.
Why is it extended? Because...
What's it included?
With the physics that it includes, or... No. The definition of the method, I just spent 10 minutes doing
what's
that.
What's different from simple DMFT?
Well, I mean, okay, so let's go back. Okay, let me answer that question, if I can. Let me see. Let me go to the extension. Okay, I understood the question. I understood the question. I will just answer it. For the Hubbard, So in this transparency, the usual DMFT would be if you set up D0 equal to 0. And then you don't have this extra self-consistent equation that you need to deal with.
Okay, so it's within the context of model Hamiltonians.
Right, but that's something which will come in part 3. And actually, perhaps this is a good point to discuss, because this is something quite philosophical. I mean, where is the boundary between model Hamiltonians and all electron calculations, which is something that I've been trying to
understand. But I should really think of it as DMFT for the extended Hubbard model.
Well, again,
at the most basic
level. At this stage, okay, so at this stage, what I've shown you is something for the extended Hubbard model, and let's sort of be precise what really was done. I mean, what was done, again, starting from some qualitative analysis, what happens to the mod transition in the extended Hubbard model, there have been developments into how to really solve these kind of equations by, for example, in the electron-phonon system. It's a more complicated system to solve, because now if you want to solve the impurity model by quantum Monte Carlo, you have a new kind of impurity model, which requires new technology. So instead of having your Ising Hubbard stratonomic variables, now you have this Bose fields that you need to decouple. So you need to introduce continuous Hubbard stratonomic variables, and that's work that was done by Yuki Motome. And then recently, Sergei Pankov, who's here, developed some semi-classical methods to simplify the analysis and to try to unravel the physics. But that was done in the context of models, in the sense that you have Vs and you have Ts. So perhaps it's a good, since you raised that question, and I think it's a provocative question, let's discuss basically where is the limit between, what's the difference between models and model, where is the difference between model calculations
and ab initio and models?
Where's the boundary? Because in practice, what has happened over the last few years, okay? I mean, in there, what do? We work pretty hard to try to develop some technique where what we need is some P alpha betas of IJs, and then some U, and then we have some VIJ, and out of there, we compute for you basically Green's functions for the emission spectra, etc. But basically, we need these TIJs and these U's, alpha, betas, gamma, deltas, and this. So this is called model. And then on the other hand is the so-called ab initio, where basically we, in principle, include all the electrons, and we have some functionals. But so, for example, we can start with density functional theory and all the electrons. But then, if you really look closely at what people actually do, then you realize that these things are not so orthogonal. What we did to arrive to the model is basically we've eliminated some degrees of freedom. And Oli will attack me here, but when you look at what people have done in electronic structure calculations, they also realize that not all the electrons are equal, that there are some guys which are core-like, and other ones are in the valence bands, and they realize that not the same computational effort should be spent in treating the two kinds of electrons. And either you do pseudopotentials, or in all electron methods like LMTOs, you treat some guys as core states. So you don't have all the electrons. You have thrown away some of it. So what makes the methods sort of more ab initio or first principles is in fact that in density functional theory or in approaches like that, such as GW, there are no input parameters. So if somehow one could get those T's and those U's and those V's from some other calculation, this would be as first principles as what, and I'm more correct than one does in total energy calculations. And in practice, what's happening? What's happening is that people are more or less saying, okay, I solved that model, but why not use that technology with the H that comes from all these programs? I mean, once you go to electronic structure methods, which are physically clever and they're based on minimal basis sets, the distance between the Kohn-Sham-Hamiltonian in LMTO basis and those T's is not so far away. So what you can do if you want to call this first principle calculation of something is simply, for example, imagine that this is a good representation of your Hoppings, and then you can sort of run your extended DMFT to describe something.
Maybe it's right that they look very much the same, but they have a different meaning.
Okay.
Isn't there also a difference in grain?
In
grain. I mean, most of those parameters in the models are at the level of the atom, aren't they? You're not looking inside the atom. You have a T or a V for an atom.
Well, as Warren alluded to, I mean, we didn't do more than just putting some T's and develop the technology for solving that. So,
what did you say? Sorry, different in grain? Wait, I just didn't understand what you said.
Well, when you do DFT, you're doing calculations with each radial point in an atom and things like this, and charges adjusting around inside the atom.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're doing these models, they're usually a single parameter for the atom.
Right. Well, okay. They're just parameters which we're trying to guess the best we can. I mean, so there's no reason why one should interpret your LMTO Hamiltonian as your TIJs, even though in principle, in practice, all it has shown for many impurities in transition metal, that's a reasonable approximation. But rigorously, what I think we should be doing is...
But maybe you say a few words.
Sure, please.
About the GW plot. No, this is a way. You just parameterize your Green function, and you have on-shell Green function as function of energy. What's wrong with it?
Well, okay. No, no. I think that this is a serious point.
You have to repeat out what you want to look at.
Sure.
You have to
sure.
Identify the sort of suitable degrees of freedom and get them out using the one electron.
Right.
Not just do it in any dumb way.
So that's why I think the boundary, that the answer to your question is that when you look at the things that are really done in practice, both what's being done in one electron community and what we are doing, the things are not so orthogonal. I mean, it requires some interpretation. So when you say, well, okay, I've done just a calculation, this technology, so the what has happened is that we learned in the last few years how to extend this technology to try to make the things more system specific. So in principle, for the DMFT, for the EDMFT, this is work in progress that is currently being done. I mean, what we're trying to do, and by we, I mean Silke and other groups, what we're trying to do is we're basically trying to use the fact that we have this nice many-body technology and we have this very nice physical way of generating orbitals, and we're trying to put them together to use the two things to get something which is system specific. But that raises lots of questions.
In answer to Mike's question, when you run the LMTO code, you do these radial integrals, but you basically reduce down an atom to a 9x9 matrix of things, right? And you're just calculating things.
That's not consistently inside an atom. Charges being moved around inside the atom.
Right. So that's
whereas if you're working with the Hubbard U, you have a single U.
But we get rid of U, yeah.
You
just
look at
wave,
it.
Wave.
Well, I mean, okay. Yeah, Sasha, in terms of organization, we can continue, for example, this next. I mean, I think it's probably better to go slow and explain the points and where. And we can continue either afterwards or we can continue next week and we can have other people speak. I mean, all I'm trying to show is which kind of, to the people in one electron theory, I just want to show you which kind of technology we have and what how they can be used.
You know, there are a lot of people which has Indian synthesis for letter U, which is in Netherlands mean really like English U, yeah? Z. So, and you could easily get rid of, yeah? So.
Easily? I don't know, but we are working on it.
No, but...
We can. I mean, I in principle, So what Sasha wants me to... what Sasha wants me to talk about, and I'm happy to skip.
Is the title of Ballas Church, you know?
Okay, so...
Life without you.
Okay, so... Okay, so, all right, so let me say a few words about that. Okay, what Sasha wants to say, even though I would have... Okay, so, all right, so that will take me a little bit outside the cavity construction. I said that there are basically two pillars on which...
But maybe you feel good.
Let me address that point since we agree to be informal. So I said there are two pillars on which this thing can rest, and when the dimensionality is infinite, these two things are completely equivalent. Once we go to finite dimensionality, this is no longer the case. And what one can try to do, a second way of thinking about the MFT is to say, I will decide that some observable is important, and then I will try to define an effective action for that observable. In other words, the classic construction is the so-called Bain-Kadanoff construction, where what you say is, what I would like to do is I would like to have my free energy as the functional of the Green's function, and then gamma of G, which is the Bain-Kadanoff functional, or gamma G and sigma, is something that we can write down as, for example, trace log G minus trace G0 minus 1 minus G minus 1 G plus here phi of G, where this is the sum of all the two-particle reducible graphs. So if we could do that, this is already different. So I'm going to now slightly switch lines. I'll try to answer two things. First, I would like to explain how we can derive dynamical mean field theory using functionals. And also, we'd like to address what Sasha wants to say, that we can really do something which looks like full many-body theory without really having to use the word U that people don't like. Okay? So, no, I mean, that's what you want me to talk about. So let me try to explain that on the board. So let me start easy first with just usual DMFT. Okay? So... this is exact. If I include here all the graphs, so if I take all the graphs up to infinite order, which is a huge mass, then I have the full many-body theory. And if here I put G of R prime, then and this line here is the Coulomb interaction V of R minus R prime, then it's clear that here I have the full many-body theory.
You mean the bare one again?
Yeah, the bare one. Now let's, in this language, let's talk about what is model and what is first principle. In principle, we cannot, or we don't want to, deal with all the full R prime dependence. And one can be clever and say, okay, for a given problem, we have certain crystal potential. What we would like to do is choose some basis, and then we will have some G alpha beta of I omega and K, where alpha and beta are basically the orbitals that we pick. And again, here we pick a complete set of orbitals, then this is as good as that, is an equivalent construction. But in practice, we have to think how to truncate our basis set, because the computers are still not infinite, and minimal basis sets in that case are extremely useful. But this, at this point, I have the full many-body problem. If you decide to go this route, now this Coulomb matrix element has to be written in the basis that you chose. But at this point, the problem is completely basis independent. Okay? So now comes the approximation. We're going to do dynamica mean field theory. Dynamica mean field theory was this local approximation that said that the self-energy was independent of K. So that means that this functional phi of G, we're going to approximate, we're going to first keep the Hartree functional, we treat that exactly. So the Hartree part we keep, but as far as the Fock part, as far as all the other things, we just do a local approximation. So we just approximate this functional, and this is now approximate. We have here phi of G alpha beta R. Sum over R. This is why it's called the local approximation. And here comes the first observation that now this, once you did this approximation, this is basis dependent. And that's why we have in this workshop the experts in how to construct orbitals, because when we now did this approximation, how we chose those orbitals, how we went from R to these bases, capital R and alpha, becomes important for the quality of the approximation.
Sorry, Gibby.
Yes.
There are two approximations there. One approximation is assuming that this is local, and the other one is truncating the bases.
Well, I mean, if you want, don't truncate the bases. Then you have only one. There are two independent approximations. Sure.
Okay, but which one are you discussing now?
Both. I just want to put on the table what it's done, so that we can have a discussion, okay? Now, and again, both approximations, Sasha forced me to change the order. The reason why I was going to do this at the end is because I wanted to explain first how we do two clusters, because then I would have been able to answer your question and say that both approximations can be relaxed, because you can either increase your basis set, or you can increase your cluster size. But since you didn't, so he didn't let me get into that, at this point there are really two approximations. Okay? So now this is using the if I just do it for the model, if I keep alpha and beta just a few indices, this is easy to see that if I differentiate this functional and I get the dynamical mean field equations, I end up with exactly the same set that I had with the cavity construction. So this, for the infinite D limit, this is exactly, and when you have a limit, the nice thing about having a control limit is that then no matter how you think about the problem, you have to get on this, to the same answer, because then you have some parameter which makes the thing exact. Now, when you don't have that, it is non-trivial to see, but it's true that you get to the same equations that you get when you did the cavity construction before. All right, so this was the level of DMFT. Now, what Sasha wants me to show you is that if I do EDMFT, I will get something which looks like the model, but now with a U which looks more first principles. So let me explain the extension. And probably then might be a good place to stop then.
Exactly.
So, yes?
When you say that, is this the full Coulomb interaction or just the density
terms? No. You start with the full Coulomb interaction, with all the multiplets and everything. Okay? I mean, And again, that's why we're having this workshop. In principle, the local approximation has absolutely nothing to do with how you truncate your multiplets. In fact, depending on the problem, you may want to keep some things and throw away others. But at this point, this is I would not truncate anything. If you keep all your alpha betas, you can keep the full form of your Coulomb interaction. Then when you go to your impurity solver, then we can discuss how to handle those things. And that will be a completely different lecture, but we have also the methods. I mean, that's why we've been working on this for a few years. Okay, so now, what happens with the, how do I get to the GW stuff and the things that Sasha wants to talk about? So now we do exactly like in models. And we, what, for example, perhaps the simplest way to do, and I will end up with this, is to introduce a Haber-Stratonovich field, and then basically I can write my problem as having some phi r, and here I will have some d0 minus 1 r prime phi r prime plus I phi of r, and then psi of r. This is exactly in the continuum. And then I would have the other terms in my action, dd tau psi plus the external potential, OK? So that's my starting point. This is equivalent to the full quantum many-body problem. So this is the starting point. And then basically what I can do is I can do the same construction that I did before, but now not just include G, but also include D, where D is the conjugate to the density-density correlation function. So that will be the expectation value of this field here. And I'm glossing over some technical details, but then what we would get, and a reference to this is a paper by Architra and me. He's a PRB. Sixty-three, 1151102001. If you want technical details, so what you have then is you have now a functional of G and D. If you want, what you have is now a functional of your density-density correlation function and your local Green's function. And then we can write what that functional is. So it has trace log G, and now has minus 1/2 trace log D, and then has more pieces. Minus 1/2 trace log D. And just like we have this term here, we have plus 1/2 D0 minus 1 minus D minus 1 times D. And then here we have the Bain-Cardano functional of the full D and the full G. And again, this is an exact reformulation of the many-body problem. So here, what I have to build is all graphs, but now they're constructed. Instead of constructing them with the bare Coulomb interaction line, now they're constructed with this line, which is this D, and what it represents is the screen Coulomb interaction. Okay, so this is a standard thing in many-body theory, just reformulating your quantum many-body problem instead of the bare Coulomb interaction in the screened Coulomb interaction. So far this is as intractable as the original quantum many-body problem. But now we can use extended DMFT and say that what we're going to do here is we're going to keep the Hartree part, but for all the correlation part, we're going to make here a local approximation. So now the approximation is to say that this phi EDMFT equals to phi Hartree plus the sum of all the local things, DII and GII. And now this is an approximation for the exact phi. Okay? But now this falls exactly in the framework of the EDMFT. All we have is just equations where we have to solve for this D. We have to solve this set of equations. All that has happened is that this D now is a matrix in orbitals. So this has four indices, the alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and GII of alpha, beta. So now what Sasha wants to say is that if we do that, we have not mentioned the word U, and the reason why I don't completely agree is because even though we have not mentioned the word U, it's really in the back of our heads when we think that this kind of approximation is a good approximation to the exact functional. But he's right, we have not mentioned the word U, and then we can use the technology of the EDMFT to get at the electronic structure problem. But again, I mean...
Does it mean that essentially you are taking a U, which is a function of omega,
yes,
as a starting point?
Yes.
In a given sense.
Yes.
Instead of starting with a model with U constant, somehow you allow as a starting model to have a U which depends on frequency.
Right. That's perfectly fair statement. And the origin of that frequency dependence can be either the orbitals that you didn't keep or the screening of the other electrons. That's the new physics that you're including, etc. But again, I mean, the formalism is cheap. It's easy to write the equations. The thing which is exciting is that we have the technology for cracking those equations. And in particular, there's a recent paper, which I guess I should advertise by Ping Sun in PRB. So he was here and he will be back later on in PRB 66085120 2002, where he really shows that in fact one actually can solve in a special case where we have just one orbital using the quantum Monte Carlo, we can solve this set of extended DMFT equations in a very simple case. Okay, so now I think that I definitely use more than my share of time, but I think that that's what you want to hear. In principle, here there is a way of addressing the problem without introducing the concept of U, but there are two things that are crucial, okay? So here you have an exact road starting from many body theory. The things that we need to discuss in the context of this workshop is, one, truncation, because we will never be able to do an infinite number of orbitals. So we have to somehow truncate the orbitals that we keep. And since this kind of approximation depends on the basis set that is used, that's one crucial thing which should be subject to further discussion. And one is the approximation of truncating, and perhaps one can do something better than truncation. Perhaps one can do renormalization. That is, integrate out degrees of freedom is much better than doing a brute force truncation. So perhaps that's one thing that can be done, or downfolding, like they said in electronic structure theory. And the other thing that needs to be discussed is the quality of this local approximation. Now, to discuss the quality of the local approximation, I need to say a few more things, how one extends the dynamic of infinite theory to clusters, because that's how we control the other truncation, but I don't know. I think that you want to hear a little bit about clusters?
Gabi, can I ask a question before I go to this? I think I have asked this in a certain context before. Since you discussed the Bain-Kalinoff scheme,
mm-hmm.
I would derive a physical picture for the approximations here by saying that the two-particle vertex is, of course, exactly related to the self-energy by the usual function of the derivative mm-hmm. with respect to the Green's function.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I mentioned before, this would limit the excitons, for example, to be on-site because your self-energy is on-site. And you would also get limits, which you partly mentioned, concerning the physics of the plasmons. But now you are using some interesting step, which I'm not sure I understood correctly, namely, right at the outset, you want to include a screening which is, let's say, RPA-like, really involving the long-range physics, and that gives you the local picture, and then in the second step,
right.
you are doing the DMF.
That's right.
So that's a different issue.
Right, yeah.
Because the screening would really be limited to density-density interactions or plasmons or excitons
yeah.
if you wouldn't do this step. Because in the usual DMFT, as I said, the self-energy right. limits the two-particle interaction.
Right, and that's why you need those extensions. I mean, with ordinary DMFT, I mean, the reason why we can attack now electronic structure is because we have extensions. For me, they're all dynamic of infinite theory, but we have all these new directions in which we can extend. And again, you're completely correct here. We only have a local exciton, but imagine that you want to describe a non-local exciton, but it extends to two sides or three sides. We still can do that, and that's the last topic I wanted to mention, which is how we go to clusters. And yes.
Question first?
Yes, sure.
When you do these new tricks,
yes.
by single out the long range term,
yes.
is there any double counting issues?
This is exact.
So no matter how
this is just a Haber-Stratonics transformation, and then the usual functional tricks, which are explained in that paper with Chitra.
Probably you ask about GW. But, you know,
I mean, you have to pronounce the D, right?
Okay. No. Again,
we'll discuss later.
Okay.
I don't need to cover clusters. We can discuss cluster next week.
Fine.
I mean,
well, that's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So just two words about clusters. First of all, there's a huge literature. Yeah.
What's the question? How this works in practice and the advantage by making this Haber-Stratonovich thing. So in the usual formulation, you have the problem that somehow you have to compute these effective interaction matrix elements
right.
and the others. And here, probably it's a similar story in the sense that somehow you need the matrix elements
yes.
of this boson fermion interaction
yes.
matrix, right?
Sure.
So what is after all?
Well, the only gain in formulating the problem like this is that it's conceptually clean. You start from the many-body problem, and then you do a consistent set of truncations. So for people who don't like U, I mean, a lot of it is philosophical here.
Yeah, but here instead of U, don't you have this electron photon?
What's underlying is the quality of the local approximation. One way or another, you have to face that. When is that a reasonable approximation? And what underlies the reason why we think this program will eventually be successful is
probably the answer is that you can do that to the first principle of Newtonian.
Yes.
This is the point.
Yeah, to begin with, but then in practice, sort of, if you go to some limited
yes.
set of orbitals,
I agree with you. I mean,
approach, you have the problem, so you do first your LDA, then you get.
No, we're not going to do LDA. I mean, the things that would ideally, I mean, the things that ultimately what I believe is going to be the correct thing at the end is to start from some local GW, because that I believe that's going to be computationally as fast as LDA. I mean, we're talking about philosophy. So I think it will be as fast as LDA and is diagrammatically controlled. But again, it's my so that's what I think ought to be done.
But then you have in mind a self-consistent GW, and then you do not get a good spectrum.
The spectrum is the reason why we okay.
So you actually do start with an LDA.
Well, again, I mean, so how to get the spectrum? No, I mean, one of the thing that really has advanced in the last 10 years is that we understand what we need to do to get the correct spectrum at the level of model Hamiltonians. This was non-obvious 10 years ago. It was in which way those GW approximations failed. And by solving the toy model, we understand precisely which kinds of approximations we need to do in each regime to do the spectra. So I would say that we understand how the technology ought to work, at least in the level of model Hamiltonian. Now, you're completely right. It has not yet been applied in this realistic framework, but that's what we're working that's why we're having a workshop. If that had been done, there would be nothing to do.
So let me just say, you're really doing two things. On one hand, you're writing down these very general functionals, which if you took G and D in the continuum would be exact.
Right.
And then, starting from this, you first write all these quantities as matrix elements in the basis.
Right.
Is it still exact if the basis was infinite?
Right.
And secondly, you make this local approximation.
Right. And then I say...
So, and in the moment you say, well, you just take a few basis functions, maybe just two or so.
Yes.
Then, I mean, in reality, you're back to the U.
Yes.
So it's,
yes.
In a way, it's a bit of a cheat.
Well, I mean,
But energy dependent. No, energy dependent.
Frequency dependent U. It's a frequency dependent U.
I understand.
Yes, you're completely right. And in reality, what has been accomplished so far? What has been accomplished so far is in the context of models, we developed the technology. So, which is really many, many years of work. I mean, because to solve and tackle those impurity models and get to the solutions, even when you have one orbital, is not completely trivial, as many people here will testify, okay? So the so in reality, what we're doing now is we're writing these general formulations. Then we hope that some renormalization of some truncation can be performed. And then we want to use the technology that we have to get to the low energy and to the spectra in a material specific way. And I agree with you, it's a very ambitious and it's a big program. But I think that we, on my side, from the many body side, I have the technology to do the last bit. And I think there's considerable advance also in how to generate these orbitals in an intelligent fashion so that we can get also the thing to work also from the one electron end. But I agree with you, this is not, that's what I agree to give here and some informal discussion, it's not a formal talk. But that's the two things that should be critically discussed. Nature of the truncation, how good is this? The LMTO orbitals are constructed in a very intelligent way. I mean, with very few basis sets, you can really describe a lot. And then the quality of the local approximation. And the thing I wanted to finish with, to give some note of optimism, is that as long as things are, when I mean local, I don't mean single site. So if things, if the single site is not very good, but the physics is still local, we can do two sites or we can do clusters. And that goes to the last thing that I was going to talk about, which is cluster extensions of the MFT. And basically, since time is short, I will just basically do two things. I will explain in the board quickly how this stuff works. Okay, I'll just do it here. All right. So what do we do? I mean, we basically do exactly the same mathematics that we did to derive the cavity construction in the single site, except that the degrees of freedom that now we keep, the way that we divide the medium and the single side electron can be now, instead of being a single side, it can be a cluster, okay? So we sort of derive a cavity construction, then now we have a G0 for the cluster, and the thing that we did, which is clever, is that we understand that the best wave functions, such as the ones that Ole produced, tend to be non-orthogonal. So we generalize this scheme to put an overlap matrix within the DMFT. But otherwise, formally, it's exactly the same as in the single site. Now we have equations for a cluster. The thing which is subtle is that there are now two concepts. And there's the concept of the cluster self-energy and the concept of the lattice self-energy. Because the cluster self-energy is whatever enters, if you think of this functional, for example, and doing the truncation that your phi is only non-zero inside the cluster, then you have a self-energy which doesn't obey translation invariance. And then what you need to do to get the lattice self-energy is you need to project out the k-dependence part of that. And just to give you some optimistic note, let me just show you one thing, which is a simple test that we've recently done of cluster DMFT in the worst case scenario, which is the 1D Haber model, because this is the worst case where any of these things have the right to work. So, but we're computing only local quantities. So what's in this graph is we took the Liebmann-Wu solution, which is the exact solution of the Haber model in one dimension, gives us the gap as a function of U. And the single side DMFT is this red curve. And I mean, it's OK, but you can see it's not great. In particular, since it's a mean field theory, it thinks it has a mod transition, even though it's in one dimension, and the mod transition occurs only at U equal to 0. But once you put the, once you go to a two-side cluster and you do the cellular DMFT construction, the results look extraordinarily good. Then when you go to three sites, then you have something which still has a mod transition, but now this region of coexistence is dramatically reduced. So I think that for local quantities, one has really a new handle in the sense that as long as we're not talking about things which are extremely long range, we can always improve. All the things I told you about can be done the same way they are done for the single site. They can also be done with a cluster. And again, we should have lots of discussions as to the various different cluster schemes. This is only one that I like. Yeah.
The cluster means that you are putting boundary conditions which are by the path. Is this, I mean,
yes.
Because if you integrate out the other degrees of freedom.
Yes. You should think of this when you're dealing with clusters, you should think of this as basically a way of putting boundary conditions. That's a very good question. So the way we think about this is the following. If you're familiar with the DMRG method, what you do in DMRG is if you want to diagonalize some finite system, what you do is you take your block, and then you take your super block. And then you use the super block to determine the density matrix, which is the bath for your block. And that allows you to do a more clever truncation of your Hilbert space. What the cellular DMFT does is says, okay, I would like to do that. I don't want to treat a cluster in isolation. I would like to treat a cluster in a medium. But I don't want to spend all my Hilbert space in solving for the density matrix of the bigger super block, because that's basically hopeless. So what I do is I make the ansatz that the Weiss field is a Gaussian variable, and then I use the periodicity of the system to infer what the bath would be by using the fact that we believe it's Gaussian when the coordination is large, and we know that the system is periodic. That's the condition that we give us the G0. And this way, instead of diagonalizing a system in isolation, you diagonalize a system in a bath. The only thing which is intelligent is that now this calculating the bath doesn't cost you very much. Yes?
Say a two-side cluster, like in this example, is the self-energy then a self-energy matrix in real space, and
right.
That is a diagonal and
it has odd and even. It has odd and even, so
bonding, yeah.
It has bonding and anti-bonding. So in this case, this projection going from the cluster to the lattice is very simple.
And sigma ij is then non-zero for I equal to j or ij, j nearest j. Right?
Yes.
Right. Do you understand why it works so well?
Well, we also did a check. Okay, I should mention Giulio Biroli did also checks in large n, and again to study how this converges as a function of size. So we took the Affleck-Marsden model, which you can solve by using collective coordinates exactly, and then we can solve it in cellular DMFT to understand the truncation, and we sort of look at how for example self energies behave and compare with different methods. So let's see what we have here. This is in a paper in PRB with Giulio. What we have here is two methods, the DCA and the cellular DMFT, after we do this this projection. And I think we did this, I think if I remember correctly, this is the two sites, and then once you go to four sites in this large N thing, even for the self energy, there's really no difference.
Okay. that Affleck Marston thing.
Yes, in the Affleck Marston. So far the two tests have been done for Affleck Marston and for one dimension Hubbard. Also for one dimension extended Hubbard.
I would say that as soon as you are getting a gap, but then the local approximation will be not bad.
Okay. Yeah.
That wasn't half filling, right? This
no, actually, we also did away from half filling.
No, I mean, this Hubbard was this 1D Hubbard.
Yeah, the 1D Hubbard we did at half filling. That was the gap as a function of U. Okay. All right. Thanks. I think it's enough.
Okay, so I think, I don't know. Going. So we still maybe afternoon we can discuss.
Well, we can do it next week. How about that? I want to get some more.
I see that there's a point to understand how to choose this kind of orbital.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I agree with you completely.
What do you want to do?
I don't have much to say about that. I mean, in terms of, I should say, I mean, in terms of. The implementation of this technology really requires a lot of work. I mean, I can show some results for some system.
A naive idea would they just take local density stuff, take all the unfolding that you need, some kind of effective band, and then you use the parameter from that side
right.
of it. But that probably is not correct because there will be some kind of accounting and so on.
Okay. Okay, good. So what we can do is, okay, so now what we can try to do is we can try to go, okay, so one way of addressing where we really are, okay? We can start from here and then try to see whether from here we get to the LDA plus DMFT, which was further down in the list of topics I was going to cover. And there what one says is those orbitals are taken from the LDA. We try to correct a little bit by double counting by shifting basically the U. The position of the F level, and then basically we can do a total energy calculation for those things. That has been done for plutonium. I mean, I can show.
The orbital coming from LDA.
This is the simplest thing.
The simplest thing. Then you have to somehow to correct a little bit because
right.
there is an overcounting.
Right.
And then to work with this little bit change the
right.
stuff.
And that was fully done by Sergei Savrasov for the case of delta plutonium. I can show some results for that. The next thing that one can try to do is let's take the GW, and that's what Silke is currently doing for nickel and iron. Let's take the bands from GW, and let's just try to put there some sort of U, I mean, and then let's see how it works.
From GW?
Yeah. That can also be done.
Now, this overcounting is clear, in principle, it's just something which is...
No, it's unpleasant. I mean, it's clear that the exchange correlation part contains already some things. So that's why the double counting, there's a lot of empirical stuff here. So that's why the double counting is not just U times N, which but it's U to N minus 1/2. I mean, this 1/2. Those things have to be understood. I mean, but again, from my side, I mean, I think my job as a many-body physicist is to provide the technology for solving those things. And once.
No, but the point is, if there is the same double counting on GW plus DMFT.
No, in GW there's no problem with double counting because you know exactly all the diagrams you have. That's why it's. No, because you know exactly which diagram is what. So the double counting problem is immediately solved by going to GW, and that's why I think that should be pushed. Well, one thing.
No. VXC, right? In GW.
No, but then you subtract it out.
Yeah. So there is no ambiguity at the level of LDA because you take out the full effect of VXC.
Right.
Right. But whatever tricks you are doing at this point has not reached the point that you can take out the full VXC, right?
Well,
you haven't taken out the full VXC from the treatment yet.
Well, that's what Silke is doing. She can show you some things for iron and nickel, perhaps next week.
But the point is, once you do GW,
Friday?
It's not the case that the
okay. Oh, you want to do now? I mean,
it's... No, it's gone.
You want to show some things? I mean, it's flexible.
No.
Maybe the question is...
No, the question is, or later this evening or next week. So this
Afternoon
or next week?
You are the organizer.
Well, okay.
Let Sasha talk this afternoon.
No, discussion.
I prefer to have some time to work in this workshop.
Then we start with Zivkin next week and cluster over 1 week because I will not be next week.
So oh, you, not, but sorry.
My interest to listen.
Hmm? So,
so
what,
you also will leave, yeah?
No, but you'll be here.
Next week, but not that
so
week.
What's booked on Monday? What happens on Monday?
Monday is free.
Okay.
Let's do it on Monday.
Let's do it on Monday. Okay, good. That's all.